running a couple of minutes late, so let's hop into it. But I just wanted to catch up with some of you. One of the great things about Elite is I know you all. And from a coach perspective, that's really makes the teaching a whole heap better. So what we're going to do is we're going to dive into factors affecting change and the six levels of change and how you need to work with that. So this will be pretty straightforward, pretty simple, but if you've got some thoughts or some feelings or some ideas or you want to seek clarification, once again, just unmute yourself and speak up. There are 13 of these things that are going to affect your ability to work with change and your ability to work with other people who are struggling in change. Remember, it's not just, you know, this session is not just about you. It's about you and handling the people that you've got to handle to get them on board. So 13 concepts to look at. Pretty much they're straightforward. The first thing that everybody looks at is, what is the impact of the change on me? So for you, the first thing to address is, okay, what is the impact of the change on me? Very interesting when you look at what we're just talking about change of locations. And Julie and Broman and myself are saying changes, pretty minimal. We were going where we wanted to go beforehand. I imagine the changes are pretty minimal for someone like Gary as well, as imagine, you know, because when you go surfing, mate, I presume you go surfing still like you used to. There's no real change there, is there?
Back to the old style, they've actually closed the car park off, so you got to walk down the bush track to go surfing, but it's good.
Cool. And what about the business in terms of the karate school via Zoom? How's that going?
Numbers are down a little bit, but it is school holidays, but I kept it going on the perspective of keeping the kids in the flow and keeping a positive atmosphere for that in change.
Yeah, cool. Right, thanks for that. So that's what I'm hearing around the world, is for a lot of people, the change is actually minimal. I think if I lived in a unit, then maybe the change would be large, particularly if there was a couple of kids and I was homeschooling. So my heart goes out to people who are doing that. But nevertheless, the first thing we do with change is we look at the impact on me. And basically, it's easy to look at change objectively when you're not directly involved in it. In other words, it's easy for us to kind of sit back and look at all the other people going berserk and all the other people behaving badly. It's easy for us to kind of go, you know, those people punching each other up in the supermarkets about the toilet rolls, you know, they're really crazy dudes and we wouldn't be like that. But that's because we're not directly involved in it. We're allowed to sit back and judge. We allow ourselves to sit back and judge that kind of behaviour. But, you know, had we been involved in that, then maybe it would be a little bit different. So that's one of the things to understand about that. The other thing is, it's kind of like the opposite of that is, and that as soon as a change impacts on your life, then you are likely to become emotionally involved, and then that's where rationality goes out the door. And so when we see people, you know, punch-ups about toilet rolls, really that's about protecting my family. Those people are compelled because their fear's got them. They're acting irrationally. You know, they're not normally like that. Of course, obviously, they're more in that direction than we are, but the reality is those people are behaving badly, not because of they're essentially bad people, but because their behaviour is turned bad because of pressure on them to do what they think needs to be done has become, you know, got to the point where they become compulsive, behave badly. So the first thing to do in affecting change is to look at yourself and say, what is the actual impact on me? And where you can identify what the impact on you is. Say, for example, Gary can't go and run the karate school. There's a definite impact in terms of getting the kids together in classes and doing their karate school stuff. Okay, so what do I need to do about that? Where is the impact on me that's not there? Well, it might be dinner times. It might be going to the supermarkets, those kind of things. A lot of impact on me is actually minimal. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we went down the supermarket the other day and we just had to stand in line a bit and stand on crosses that they'd put on the floor, work our way into the supermarket, stay away from everybody else. You know, the impact is minimal. So when I say the impact on me, I didn't mean me personally. A lot of change doesn't really necessarily impact on us to the degree that we think it does. So I think a good thing is an audit. What does a change actually mean for me? Because for many of us, we're talking about the change more than we're actually affected by it. and we're looking at it on a global scale, and holy moly, this is impacting on everybody. You know, it's kind of one of those things where we look at it. To me, it's just a number. When I hear that in the US, 26 million people unemployed, it's too big a number for me to comprehend. So I don't really get what it is they're talking about. The impact on me is minimal. The number of people in Australia who are, you know, the impact on them, once again, it's kind of one step removed from me personally. You know, we look at, I said to Mary, you better find out if we qualify for some of this government money. And for those who don't know, we could get $1,500 per employee. If our turnover is down by 30%, well, we had a look at our turnover is up by 30%, and I'm whinging and pissing and moaning, and I'm carrying on and saying to Mary, this is shit, this is a disaster. But at what time in the history of the world was your profit going up? Was that a problem? So, you know, it's kind of like, what is the impact on me? You know? Yeah, Gary's saying, punch me up the side of the head. You know, who in business would be looking forward to a 30% decrease unless you were already 25% and saying, okay, if we could get another 5, we'd qualify for the money. But when you think about it, a lot of this stuff is kind of at the ridiculous level. So that's your first thing. Impact on you, just how big, just how serious, just how much. I think what most of you will find, I'll actually ask some of you in a moment, I think what a lot of you will find is the impact is a lot less than it is on the people around you. I'll quickly just, Michael, what do you reckon? The impact on you, large or small?
Very, it's the other way. It's been very positive. I was just working out, I did a comparison. We turned over about one third of our business in 1 month's work. And I've done that in 3 weeks of trading.
Uh-huh. Cool.
So the answer is very positive for us.
So you'd have to say you're sailing along.
Yeah.
Cool. Gary, impact on you? I kind of tried to predict it, but you can speak for yourself.
Pretty minimal, except for doing the electronic teaching.
Uh-huh.
Electronic karate school, that's all. Lisa sighed hugely. She's working from the home office and trying to go into the never never with her business.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Cool. Luke, what about you guys? I'm not sure if Lee is with you. Impact for you guys?
Yeah, it's I guess it's some things are a bit busier. I know that we're doing a lot more with the kids and bonding. Business, I guess some things are quieter, but other opportunities are coming sort of at the same time, aren't they?
We focused one whole side of our business on micro small business, and they're just not spending money right now. But we always knew that that probably wasn't the smartest thing and we should focus on some bigger businesses. So now we're in a position where that just has to happen. So in that way, I think it sort of pushed us into an area we weren't as comfortable in, but we just have to get over that and move on anyway.
Yep. And that's an interesting thing is that, you know, we get pushed into an area that we're not comfortable. The only reason you weren't in that area before is you weren't comfortable.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
We kind of shoot ourselves in the foot because when we're the boss, we can say, bugger it, that's a bit uncomfortable, I'll leave that till tomorrow. When the circumstances say, do it now or else, we kind of go, oh, all right, and we get on with it.
Yeah. You know,
we turn into geniuses. Robin, impact on you?
Oh, probably no impact on me. I only went shopping once a week anyway. I do a lot of stuff from home. Oh, sorry, there is an impact. Going to Sydney and seeing my mum. I haven't, because if I go there, I actually cannot go into the nursing home anyway.
Yeah.
So I could go to Sydney, but I still actually can't see her. 1st of May, this rule about vaccination just rules me out totally, so I'm working my way around that.
Mm-hmm.
So I may never get to see her again. I don't know. That's a bit of a that's a bit of that fear thing of what may be in the future.
Yep. But
otherwise, everything else is good.
Cool. Let's go to Kay. I'm just interested in the level of impact on. Thanks, Bronwyn.
Yeah. So for me, Paul, it's been a really interesting situation. So I'm contracted to a company. We've been in work from home mode now for about, this will be week 8 for me. And I just had my father-in-law lives with us. So for him, he's not been able to go out as he usually does. So helping him sort of come to terms with that's been one thing. But also at a more personal level, my niece has actually lost her job, you know, and her mum's helping her with money and that sort of thing to live in Sydney because it's expensive. I've got two neighbours who have their own business, and they've got young children, and both of them have they can't do anything with their business either. So I think at a personal level, both my husband and I are really grateful we still have our jobs. We can, you know, pay our bills and put food on the table. But directly around me, and when I go to the shopping centres, I have to go more frequently, and I'm the only one that goes out now. So my life has actually probably increased in the stress level, and I'm still grappling in some areas of managing that. And also when I go to the shopping centres now, I just see the immense amount of fear and distress on people's faces. And it's not easy. You go there, you can't get everything you need. You have to go back more often, and things like that. So, but from a positive perspective, we're well, we're fortunate, and all of that. But it's certainly at that level. And like Bronwyn, I've not been able to see my mum. I mean, she's well, and luckily they're on a little bit of land as well. So thank goodness. They've just recently moved, which has been great for them because they've got something to occupy their time. But again, I haven't been able to sort of see her as much as I like. But apart from that, yeah, look, very fortunate. And as you said, just adapting as we need to. So, yeah, that's it, Paul.
Cool. Thanks, mate. It's one of those things where I've noticed that when we go out in the shops, I see something different every day. So I have seen plenty of fear, and I have seen plenty of the other stuff. I've also seen plenty of helping out and kind of quiet friendliness, and it's sort of like we're all in this together kind of attitude. So, you know, I think it depends on the day, and that probably depends on the people that you're bumping into. It probably depends on how I'm feeling. Let's go to you, Ange. Impact on you? Having trouble with your volume there, mate.
Oh, can you not hear me? I'm on my phone because I couldn't get the... Anyway, can you hear me now?
No? Is that any better?
Yeah, can you hear me? I don't know if you can hear me or not.
Vaguely. Well, no. I'll come through at my end. What we might do is just leave you with that. We've spoken to Michael. Actually, I'd like to hear from you, Jules. What's your thing about the impact on you?
Me?
Yeah.
In what sense? I already said life's pretty normal.
Oh, okay. Cool.
I'm not sure what you mean. Sorry.
Well, it was just your picture there, and I thought people might be interested in how you're handling it all.
Well, our life is normally pretty isolated. We either are on the road with people travelling and around a lot of people, or we're at home taking the space. So I'm at home taking the space, other than Bob the Builder, who's coming in all the time. but I am struggling with all of my loved ones being away because normally I would be on the road to go and see them. And at the moment, the three-year-old doesn't really want to be near any cameras. So FaceTime isn't happening. But I just remind myself that's not personal, it's not permanent, and I've been sending her little letters, which, you know, she's only 3, so it's the first letters she's ever gotten, and she gets excited about getting mail. So that's probably all there is.
Cool.
And there's more people in the development and out and about than there normally is, so there's a lot of people at home, but that's about it.
Sweet. Okay, thanks, mate. Let's go to Daniel. Impact on you, mate?
Hi, Paul. Well, as you know, I work from home anyway. So in terms of working environment, it's pretty much the same. You know, I've got stuff comes through and I do that and so on. What has had an impact is obviously the kids are off. So they're home. So homeschooling is challenging, and I'm trying to teach them to be a bit more resilient and not just come and interrupt every 5 minutes because they can't be bothered to think for themselves, basically, I think is what we've determined they're doing. The number of times they've come in and said, I don't get it. And we say, well, read the question. And they read it and I go, well, what don't you understand about that? I don't know, I just don't get it. And I'm like, well, which word don't you understand? That one. Well, ask Google what it means, you know. So we're teaching them to sort of do a bit of research and learn for themselves, you know. But from an emotional perspective, it's some, obviously there's that, it's making it harder to focus work-wise. But as I say, we're doing that. But with my folks, I mean, they're in the UK anyway. So, and my dad's on the vulnerable persons list, the official vulnerable persons list, because he's got a heart issue. But they seem to be handling it fairly well. But from my perspective, it's not like I was going to jump on a plane and go visit them anytime soon anyway. But just the knowledge that suddenly the planes aren't, I mean, there are flights, but they're very, you know, there's not many kind of thing. But the knowledge that, you know, there's no flights, as they say, it's like you don't miss something till it's gone. You know, it's suddenly the thought of being able to go visit them now that it's gone, that's kind of distressed me a bit. And I've been kind of, I've gotten over it now, but I was worried for a while. I was thinking, well, what if this never clears up? What if I never see them again? This sort of thing, you know? Yeah. But that was just fear and panic kind of thing. I've sort of gotten over that and been talking with them. But that's me, really. Pretty much. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Who else? We'll just get a quick touch base from Rick.
Can you hear me?
Vaguely, mate.
Okay. Yeah, I'm an employee and I'm still employed. Been working from home for a couple of weeks. Then I had to go back to the office for a couple of weeks to train a new employee under me. So that was interesting. But I'll be home from now on, hopefully. And working from home is different. I think I'm more productive, actually, because less interruptions, less distractions, and yeah, quite enjoying it. Sitting here in your shorts and bare feet and not having to travel anywhere. It's good.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. All right. We have a few other people on the line, but I'm not going to go to them on account of we're chewing up a bit of time that I hadn't planned on. But thanks for the feedback. I think it's kind of important to hear just exactly where everybody else is at because, it seems to me there's a bit of a consensus about it isn't that bad. So, let's look at the second thing in terms of handling change. The second thing in terms of factors that are going to affect how well you do with it is how much control you have. So the next place for you to do a bit of a self-assessment is, okay, so our perception change can be altered whether we feel like we're a part of it or not. So that really comes down to, you know, if you feel like the change is being forced on you or done to you, then it tends to be much more uncomfortable than if you feel like you had some kind of say in it. So if you feel like, you know, you started it or you invented it or you came up with a process for it, then generally speaking, you're going to be more capable of implementing that change, whatever it is. Because when it comes from you, the natural question is, since it's your idea, then you naturally flow on to, so what have I got to do to make that happen? So, you know, we're doing a renovation on our farmhouse, haven't touched it for 30 years since we built it. And so since we decided we were going to do that, then it's kind of like, okay, well, what do I need to do? Where do I start? What will we change? What will stay the same? And we get on with it. And it's easy to do because it came from within. Had somebody come to us and said, you have to do that as a matter of law to keep it up to standard, you know, because, you know, the rules say that it's old and dilapidated or something, then I would feel like that was forced on me and I'd be rebellious and I'd be difficult and I'd feel like it was, you know, I would be doing the bare minimum and I wouldn't be enjoying it. It would be work that I was forced into rather than I was doing by choice. And yet it's actually all the same thing. It's laying the same bricks. It's putting the same pieces of timber up. It's painting the same thing. So it's actually the same work, but my level of control over it affects how I feel in terms of putting that effort in and whether that effort is, you know, drudgery or whether that effort is actually kind of fun. So really important. I think the house renovation thing is pretty cool. We kind of we had the floor sanded, and the floor sander dude said, you got to take the skirting boards off, which we'd done a heap of work to fix them up. And we, you know, taking them off, we broke them all and all, you know, that sort of stuff. So we're putting new skirting boards, and I was just painting them the other day thinking, you know, this is really pleasant. I'm just sitting here listening to an audio book while I'm standing there actually walking around, listening to an audio book, painting a pretty simple surface coming out of the factory. So it wasn't difficult painting with a and I was doing it with a roller. And I put a few hours in. I suddenly noticed I was exhausted from the physical effort, but I'd been really kind of powering on and enjoying it. Simply because, you know, it was kind of, I was getting an achievement done. It was something that was under my control and that I could feel progress with. So I think that that's really important concept to understand, is that how much like you feel like you're in control of it is important. The real question is, how much of it that's out of your control can you get in your control? Because I think that it's fairly easy to say there's things that are under your control and things that aren't. By the way, the reason I'm spending a bit of time on this is that in my whole 35 years in this industry, the place where I've seen most wasted effort is where people are worrying about things that they can't control. And I heard a couple of examples while you guys were talking. Daniel was talking about the flights to England, totally outside Daniel's control. Therefore, spending time or emotional energy on it actually doesn't change anything, whereas if Daniel was actually had some influence about how often they fly, well, then he could write his letters and he could make his protests and he could do whatever. But since that's all just going to go up in the ether, then you might as well not bother. So what I see is people spending, I mean, Daniel's example is not a really good one. Where I see most people wasting time and energy is saying, it shouldn't be like this. I wish it didn't happen. I wish we hadn't been sent into lockdown. I wish the coronavirus never turned up. I wish that my boss was a better person. I wish that it wasn't like this. I wish we lived in a different house. I wish that was blah, 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 blah. So where I see most energy wasted is where it's poured into wishing to change that which we cannot change through our own efforts, which means it's really important for you to have a look at what do I have control over and what don't I, and separate them into two separate categories. Once you get them separated into two separate categories, it's a question of going, okay, the things I don't have control over, they go over there and I just have to wait and see what happens. The things that I do have control over, that's where I need to focus, because that's where I can actually make a difference. That's the critical thing at this level, is what do I have control over and what don't I? And how do I focus on the ones where I do have the control, or where I do have influence in what takes place? Next thing to look at is something allied to that, and that's when things are going on around you, but you may not have initiated them yourself. So when there's an opportunity to contribute to the change, what we find is that we go a whole lot better with it if we feel like we have some input into what's going on. So if you're involved in a group or a committee or a discussion group or a family or a situation where things are need to be done in a group rather than on your own, then it's important that you allow yourself to buy in where you are able to contribute. This gets important in area for the level that I was talking at, but it also gets important for people like Ange, because Ange's got a big team of people. Let me look through my list and see who else is working with a large group. Not that many of you, so this is more particular to Ange, but let's kind of just broaden it. We all know what I'm talking about when it's, you know, if you have some say in what's going on, it's easier for you to be involved in that, whatever that might be. For Ange, where she's running a business, has a number of employees. What you have to do, Ange, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, right? I'm just talking to you as a, this is what I would do. I'm not coaching you in this. Does that make sense? I'm about to give you some advice that I should not give you. Not because coaches don't give advice. What I'm going to suggest is that you run the business like a benevolent dictatorship. In other words, what you say goes. You're the boss. You say how it is. You employ who you want. You sack who you want. You run it how you want. You tell people to behave to a certain level of standards. And those standards are all things that you decide are critical, because that's what you're having. That's the way you're going to run your business. at the same time, you give everybody in your team the impression that their contribution matters, that they have a say in how it goes, that you're inviting their contribution, that their contribution has value and that it's important, but you'll encourage that interaction between them. When push comes to shove, you're the one who makes the decisions. If you can make that distinction, if you can make people feel included in the decision-making process, they will be much more likely to get that change and run with it when it comes along. The more it feels like you're dictated, which is what I'm actually saying, is that you'd be a benevolent dictator. The more they feel like you're a dictator, the harder it is to get them to be involved in it. The more they feel like they collaboratively came up with those ideas, then the easier it is for them to run with it, the less direction you have to keep putting into the business. So that's a distinction that for all of you is going to be important over some period of time. Number four on our list, not necessarily in order of importance, by the way, but another factor in affecting how we handle change is our perception of it. So from this perspective, if we perceive the change to be positive, we tend to behave positively towards it. And of course, the opposite is true. When we believe that the change is negative in nature and that it's going to have negative consequences, then we engage in much more negative behaviours towards it. Now, why bother mentioning that in a situation like this? Well, because a lot of change you're stuck with, and therefore you might as well bring the positive to it. So this is a little bit like at the level of saying your gratitudes each day. You know, it's saying that you're grateful for what you've got doesn't appear to affect the outside world. And maybe people don't behave differently because you're grateful about what they're doing. But you feel different. So one of the most powerful concepts in personal attitudes, beliefs, and mindset is a concept of gratitude. What I'm going to suggest that you do is that you continue to focus on what you do have rather than what you don't. I think Kay's summary was a pretty accurate one, that essentially Kay's lucky that she and her husband have still got their jobs, they can still pay their bills, essentially, financially, no pressure. There might be pressure, but it was there before anyway. In other words, you know, lots of us could earn more and be happy about it, right? So I'm not saying you're financially blessed. I'm saying you're financially blessed to have not taken a backward step, Kay. So what we need to do is focus on what is great, because it changes what we bring to what is not great. And what's going to be difficult, you've got your father-in-law living with you, you're the only one to go outside and, you know, do stuff and all that, and you bump into all the people who are experiencing the fear, etc. All of these things are fair enough, but you'll find that you handle the outside world a whole lot better when you handle the inside world a whole lot better. And when we go out grateful that we have the opportunity to go that, you know, like I'm still amazed. You know, it's difficult to go to the shops and deal with, you know, stuff not being there. I'm still amazed that we have the capacity to go to the shops, that when we go there, you know, I'm stunned. I'm absolutely gobsmackingly, positively stunned by what I see going on out there. Because we go to the supermarket, there's all these cross marks on the floor, and you stand there on the way to get in, and I think, you know, people just standing there just doing that. You know, in America, there'd be riots. There'd be people saying, you're not pushing me around, you're not telling me, or whatever it is. And I can see that there might be a future where that's the way we shop. Of course, that'll push a lot of things online, which is probably, you know, a smarter way to go to the grocery shop anyway. But the reality is that what we are grateful about working for us affects how we see everything else. That's critically important thing to say for yourself, to experience for yourself, and to pass on to others. Because essentially one of the important things about how our culture handles this boils down to how you handle it and what message you propagate out there. And so when you're out there excited about life and what it has to offer and the opportunity of life, and when we bring cheerfulness and positivity to the environment that we're in, the other people who need it pick up on it. Next thing to look at is what is the ultimate purpose of the change. So we can look at that and say, well, even if change is unpleasant, or maybe even if it's uncomfortable, we can still go along with it if we can see that there's a better reason for it, if there's a community good, if there's something that gives us meaning and substance to going through the transition or dealing with things difficult. And I think, you know, probably as a good example, you know, one of the difficult things is we look at, you know, the difficulty, say, of Bronwyn not being able to visit her mother-in-law. So, you know, and the same is true for Gary and perhaps Kay and some of the others. Certainly, I'm extremely worried about going to visit my mum because I may have been in contact with somebody who's got the virus and I don't know that I've got it. I go and visit my mum. She's 92. She's pretty frail and that takes her out. And so I deal with not visiting my mum from two perspectives. One, I'm 1,000 kilometres away and my sister's taking care of her. And that's really a job that I would find enormously difficult. But secondly, I rationalise it to myself saying, but if I do, then I might be the one who kills her as a consequence of my actions. And so I don't go and visit the other older people I know in the nursing homes and do all those kind of things. I'm not a fan of isolation, but I'm participating for the sake of other people, for people who are suffering, you know, particularly my friend Bob, you know, just his immune system is absolutely smashed to pieces. He won't admit that, but his immune system is ratchet as a consequence of all the chemotherapy and the radiotherapy and that kind of stuff. So not seeing my, you know, my very close friend, I rationalise by saying there's a greater good. And so I'm going to suggest to you that, you know, when you're struggling with things that seem unfair or seem like they're impinged on you, then have a look at, you know, is there some greater good? This is the kind of thing that we need to do in larger situations. Like I said, my grandfather went to the First World War. He went for the common good. He didn't go, you know, I suppose he was willing to die. He was willing to take the risk of dying, but he didn't go because he was a warmonger and wanted to go and have a fight. He didn't, pardon me. The last thing on his mind was getting into a battle and you know, being involved in damage to other human beings. He found it enormously difficult to talk to us about what happened in the war because it was so ugly that I can tell in hindsight that he suffered from PTSD, and so there were things he would never talk about, in particular what happened in the war. But he went for the greater good. He went because he saw that maybe the life of all of us was more important than the life of him. A staggering concept when you think about it, and perhaps that's something that we, you know, is a little bit lost on some of our other generations. So be aware of what might be the bigger purpose in a change that you might have to just deal with. Next thing is expected response. So this is a classic because you would have heard me say in other talks and other situations where we've been together, expectations lead to disappointment. What we mean by that is when I'm expecting something to work and then it doesn't, then I get disappointed. But if I approach it with an open mind and wait and see how it goes, then I'm not so disappointed if it doesn't work so well. So expected response has a lot to do with actual response when results turn up. So it's pretty important that we enable ourselves to plan for the worst, hope for the best, and expect nothing. Now, it's an interesting thing. People tend to want us to be strong. So everyone around you will look for you to be the strength in their community. It's a very unusual thing for me to be talking to a group of people who are not influential in their circumstances. And as I look through my list on my screen of all of you out there at the moment, I see universally you are influencers. You are people that other people look to. From that perspective, understand that the attitude that you bring to things, like I said in the previous session, has a lot to do with how people travel. From your own perspective, what I'm going to suggest is expectations are really, really important for you to take a step back with. So I want to go into the territory of talking about the fear of the unknown. When I say to you, and I said to you about an hour and a half ago, we never really did know and we never really can know. A lot of us understand that intellectually, but we don't get it emotionally. It doesn't really hit. We still want things to be how we want them to be, and the unknown still bothers us. What I'm going to suggest to you is about responses, about your expectations. It's really, really important that you do three things all at once that appear to be mutually exclusive. The first is prepare for the worst. But the second is hope for or expect the best. In other words, don't get nailed because you didn't prepare when things went bad. Secondly, don't spend too much time on that because 90% of our disasters that we imagine never happen anyway. So, you know, we could waste a lot of time on that. But thirdly, secondly is expect that things would go positively. But thirdly, step back from expectation, knowing that you're setting yourself up for disappointment if you do have an expectation, and that the only real perspective you could bring to a project, a change, a mechanism, a thought, a product, anything new that you're going to do, the only realistic proposition or mindset that you can bring to it is this could work or it could fail. For those of you who heard me talk about business projects, what I say is keep launching boats, keep pushing boats out there, keep build a boat, push it in the water. You never know about a boat until you push it in the water. It could be the best looking boat in the world, but it's not until you push it in the water you find out how it's going to float, whether it's going to float or whether it's going to sink. In business to ideas, in working with people, not everything works. A lot of the boats that we have faith in, they sink. And we get devastated when they sink because we put so much energy into them. You guys probably haven't heard me talk about a thing that I developed years ago called Coach Curly. And the whole idea of Coach Curly was that we'd set up this website and people could volunteer to be coached, and I'd do a session with them where they'd get a breakthrough, and we could put all that up on the net, and people would see these sessions where in, you know, an hour or 90 minutes, there'd be a massive breakthrough for whoever wanted it, and that would cause an avalanche of customers to come towards us, and we would just be overwhelmed. We'd be drowning in customers. And so I put plenty of time and plenty of effort in that, including getting the cameraman to fly from Brisbane, but we had to buy him two seats because he wouldn't check his camera in. So we had to buy a seat for his camera and his tripods and all that shit. So, and then we had to pay him as well. So it was a pretty expensive adventure and spent plenty of time on it and got some great footage and did some brilliant work, did some absolutely brilliant work, life-changing work. And you know, that project sank without trace. That project just went nowhere. And I remember that for the effort that we put in, it should have been a much greater success than it was. And probably if we brought today's level of knowledge to it, maybe it would work. But the reality is 8 or 9 years ago when I did that, it just sank without trace. It was such an abject failure that was not even an oil slick on the water where it sank. And most people said to me, oh, you're disappointed. You put so much time and you put so much money and you put so much effort into it. And yes, I was disappointed. But we're still looking for a way to find new customers. So we just chucked it and moved on to the next project. And the next project turned out to be a winner. What am I saying? I'm saying push the boat out, wait and see if it floats or if it sinks. If it sinks, don't worry. Get the next boat and push that out. We need to be constantly thinking about the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. Because if we're not moving forward. And if we're not moving forward, then we get caught short because we're not moving forward. So expect the boat to float, but be ready for it not to. If it floats, you beauty, maybe you can work on that boat, make it prettier, paint it up, get a motor in it, do all sorts of stuff to the boat to make it work better. You know, from that point of view, I'm reminded of our friends Andrew and Daryl Grant, who they launched an ebook probably 15 or 20 years ago, and that thing was pretty much break even. They were spending about $400 or $500 a day on ads, and they were selling $400 or $500 worth of books, and it was pretty much a break-even affair. So it was a boat that was barely floating. We had a chat about it. We got a breakthrough at the emotional level about their personal understanding of what success meant and all those kind of things. We did some deep work on that, and they made some changes to the project that it started to make $1,000 US a day, and it did that for the next 7 or 8 years. So I want you to imagine a project that delivers $1,000 US a day for you and ask yourself, what's it depend on? The reality depends on pushing a boat out, that's it, to see if it floats, and if it floats, making some adjustments and getting it to work. Because that's pretty much how most things go. Therefore, the formula boils down to plan for the worst, expect the best, but separate yourself from expectation push it out, wait and see what happens. But be positive with all the people that are around you. I'm just going to see if that makes sense. I'm flicking through my video feeds. If that makes sense, you can just nod or wave or something like that. That will allow me to move on with the next concept. Beauty, thanks. Okay, that's pretty cool feedback. Okay, remember, we can sometimes feel wrong for worrying for voicing our concerns about things. Therefore, it's important that you do what I've just been talking about inside your own head, that what you display externally is positive, but you do the three things that I'm talking about. Let's move on to the next concept. This has got to do with how often change happens. So when there's one-off change or there's change for short periods of time, that's a lot easier to manage than when the change looks like it's constant or that the constant threat of change is never going to go away and it's going to unsettle everyone. So what you've got to do there in terms of your own assessment is have a look at it and ask yourself, with what I'm doing, is it permanent? Is it temporary? Is it just to get through or is it the new normal? Because if the change looks like it's going to be the new normal, then that can change things a lot bigger and further down the track. Let's say, for example, that Gary discovers that running the karate school via Zoom actually works really well. Now, that's probably yet to be determined, but if we pick it randomly and say, okay, that works really well, then how does he turn that into the new normal? Does it mean that he doesn't need a premises to operate anymore? Does it mean that he can now have students who live a lot further away? For those who don't know, Gary lives in Marimbula, and so pretty much the karate school up until now has been limited to having students who are physically within the location that allows him to turn up at the venue, which I think is in the township, isn't it, Gary? The school's within the township?
Yeah, in the main plaza downtown, yeah.
Yeah, so basically that means anybody further than, say, 20 kilometres out, not really a candidate to be in the karate school, but if it does turn out to be successful because of the Zoom thing, then maybe that means the people in Bega and Wollongong and New York can get themselves involved. Make sense? Cool. So we'll look at that and say, okay, so if I can keep my mind open, then the question arises, okay, if the karate school goes into being a Zoom operation, or primarily a Zoom-based operation, and that doesn't mean it can't go back to being physical, but maybe you can have the physical location for the people who can get there combined with someone holding a camera running Zoom for people who are unable to get to the lesson. And they may be unable to get the lesson because they live in Perth or because, you know, whatever. Then does that change the operation? And if it does, what are the changes and will everybody be able to handle that? And if so, how successful is that? That's different to if it starts differently. So, for example, we've got one of our coaches at the moment who's decided she's going to run a course. I'll ask Julie to describe what the course is at the moment. But do you want to just talk a little bit about what Sonia's up to and the doubt she's been experiencing and then how it's kind of blown itself out of the water, Julie? Do you want to just quickly tell that story?
I couldn't even tell you what the course is about. I know that I read the sales page to check for any issues, but she's running a mini class, like a six-week class, and has spent 8 months not getting started and saying, like, I have to work out what I'm going to do and spending endless hours with you and the group working out what she's going to do. And then all of a sudden just gave it a shot, I think because we put the pressure on her during a training. And then she was panicking that it was all not going to work. And so she was sending me emails that would take nearly a half hour to read for every thought process she'd ever had. And it was full of self-doubt and she just got trigger happy and self-indulgent in the worry. And I don't mean that negatively. She said to me in her reply, she got self-indulgent in winding up in the story. And of course she waited 48 hours and she's got 8 registered or something. So she didn't give herself enough time before she hit the panic button to actually let things take effect. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Thanks, Jules. And the only bit that I'd add to that, because I've been included on the emails and she's got 8 people registered in a few days, but like the majority of those people are from foreign countries, aren't they, George? So she's got people like from US and Serbia and all around the world. So she's got 8 clients from, like, you know, the world, so to speak. So really what I'm saying is that's different to what Gary might consider. And the whole idea of this is that what you understand is that you can handle change probably faster than everybody else can. So make sure that as you institute change, you don't bring it on too quickly for everybody else to handle, and that you keep everybody else up to speed on that. Otherwise, that's where you run into trouble. From that perspective, the information that you provide or that you get provided to you turns out to be pretty much the key factor in what's going on. For most people, they're going to feel like they are more in control when they have more information. Therefore, this is a time when you keep the information flow happening. For people like Ange with a team of, you know, a bunch of physiotherapists who are all kind of like, you know, highly intelligent, highly qualified, and all perfectly capable of having their own opinions, then the flow of information from Angela is critically important. And sometimes you even have to go as far as saying, like when you have nothing to say, you need to call a meeting to say that you have nothing to say, because the flow of information, the transparency of what's going on, is critically important. If you look at how Australia has handled the coronavirus, probably better than most countries, we're certainly not the top, but we're in the top group, then a lot of that has got to do with public figures standing up and being as transparent as possible. You look at people like Jacinda Ardern, you know, world famous for being a transparent leader in New Zealand. Funnily enough, New Zealanders are not that keen on her. She's likely to lose the next election, but she's admired worldwide for transparency. When you think about it, that's critically important when it comes to handling change for yourself and for those around you. Number 9, like I said, these are not necessarily in order of importance. Then basically, we need tools and techniques. And if we feel like we're not capable of managing the change, then we don't want to even start. Therefore, the change gets to be critically important, not so much from the point of view of what the change is, but do we have the equipment to handle it with? Are we going to be provided with the tools? Is someone going to give us the guidelines? Is someone going to provide the rules? Is someone going to tell us, you know, what I need to know for me to be able to feel secure about that? You know, with a coaching group that we run just recently, and we were talking about who qualifies to get a government assistance package. And, you know, both people on the call had a different opinion about who qualified. They're both reading the same document. So it's critically important that we get clarity about what the rules are, what the information is, what the processes are that we want to undertake, who's got to do what, when they've got to do it, how they've got to do it, how it's going to be measured. All of those things are important, because when we've got the tools and we've got the techniques to manage the change, then we're going to have a more positive approach to change, because we know what we're doing. We feel like we know what we're doing, and we look to everybody else like we know what we're doing. So making sure that you're equipped with what you need and everybody else is equipped with it is part of succeeding. Number 10 on our list is your preference personality-wise. And the truth is, some people prefer rapid change. You know, if you are of the north or the east persuasion, then change is kind of like, you know, one of your friends, and you kind of like to do it just because, you know, change for change's sake is good. You know, my mum, 92 years old, still likes to rearrange the furniture every few weeks. And, you know, she just likes change for, you know, amusement's sake. She likes to change coffee shops, even though the coffee shop she goes to is perfectly capable. She just, you know, got that thing where she just wants, you know, she just likes to have a change. Some people don't. Some people go to the same place for their holidays every year. You know, you'll know someone who buys a caravan in a caravan park because they go there, and they go there for holidays for 40 years. So, you know, it's really about a personality thing. And your preferences personality-wise are going to impact both on the amount we like change and the approach that we're going to take to it. So expect the people who are south and west to resist change just for the sake of resisting it. You know, the perfectionists are just going to push back against you. And when you say why, they're going to have some weird-ass, hard-to-justify reason, because emotionally they're just kind of pushing back because they don't want it to move too quick, because they can stay in this comfort zone if the change is managed at a slower rate. Others are going to go nuts because the change isn't happening quick enough. It's important for you to know the people in your world. Are they north? Are they east? Are they south? Are they west? What is their preferences when it comes to change? Because what you'll find is that, you know, you've only got to say five words to the northeast and boom, they're off and running. And, you know, for the Westies, you've got to provide five books explaining the reasons why and how it's going to be implemented and who's going to do what and the reasoning behind that and the logic and the systems and the processes and the mechanics. And then, you know, they'll get on board. So treat everybody differently as far as you can tell what their personality is concerned. But be very aware of your own risk profile. Because what happens for me and Mary is that I'm much more leaning towards change. She's much more leaning against it. What that means is we battle about the approach instead of battle about the best solution. I told you about that before. I won't drag you through that again. Then understand that pretty much everybody goes through the same process. We just want to go through at a different speed. So some people want to go quick. Some people want to go slow. It's kind of like what I was saying about the perfectionist kind of pushing back against it. But basically your position on that change curve or your personality is going to determine your response more than what the actual change itself is. So be aware that it's different for everyone and that you need to adjust your speed to not scare the ones on your team that are going to get scared by the change happening too quickly. That, of course, has to be tempered with putting a bomb under the arse of those who are just resisting for the sake of resisting. Next thing to look at is position on the change curve. I just kind of alluded to that. So it's pretty important that you understand where you are on the change curve at any time that it happens and then where everybody else is. Because the leadership in the situation depends on who's furthest along the curve. So you don't really want people on your team further along the curve than you are, because what that means is if you're the leader of the team, you're trying to lead from behind. What that means is if you own your own business, and most of you do, then you kind of got to get on the front end of that change curve, because anybody on your team needs you to be further ahead than they are. They need you to be figuring out what we need to do next and what direction we're going to go in and why that's going to be okay and how come everybody's going to be safe and, you know, that kind of thing. So your job as a leader is going to be kind of more in focus whilst we're going through change and at any other time in the business. And then number 13 is preferences. So this boils down to how you get your motivation. So your motivation preferences are going to affect both the amount of the change we like and the approach that we take to it. So I'm much more inclined to go, let's change everything and let's do it now. And that means it's okay to get everything we've got now and chuck it out. Of course, that strikes fear into Mary's heart because she just sees good stuff being chucked out. And on many occasions, she's correct about that. So her motivation is to preserve what is good and to build on that. What we will do is we'll have an argument about who's right instead of understanding there's a third alternative that's better than that. And we've got to be involved with each other and engaged with each other at such a level that we find the third alternative. Because if we don't find the third alternative, we don't get 1 + 1 = 3. And that's actually where success is going to come from. What that means is we have to be vulnerable. Really what I've been aiming at this whole time we've been talking is that going into the unknown means you become vulnerable. If you actually admit that you don't know what's going to happen next week, if you actually admit that you are the only person you've got in your life, that the person you love the most dearly could be gone tomorrow, if you understand the frailty of the human condition, you'll understand that in your vulnerability is where your strength is. This is a message from Brené Brown's work. If you're wondering about her, if you haven't read Brené Brown's stuff, you will absolutely love it. She talks about being vulnerable is where you find your courage. And if you've been to a boot camp with us, you'll have seen people stand up the front and talk about, you know, their worst moments in their life, the things they're most ashamed of having said or done. And they make themselves extraordinarily vulnerable. But to do that, they display enormous amounts of courage. And what people in a crowd notice is the vulnerability, who cares, but the courage, I'm so inspired and motivated by that. that I discover I'm inspired by that person as a human being. And I find more within myself when I see that level of demonstration. But it's when you are naked that innovation, creativity, and change are going to show up. In other words, if we go back to what I was saying to you about, I was talking to a client yesterday where I specifically said to him, go and sit in a place, well, I initially said to him, go and sit at the beach for periods of up to an hour and a half at a time to find out what you want to do. Essentially what's happened to this guy is his career's come to an end. And so that's because the companies that he worked with, they've all changed direction. And so he can't do what he used to do for a living. So he has to find a new way to earn a quid. He's only in his mid-40s. And he's panicked about how does he bring his family and his kids and all that, you know, how does he bring them up with no income, and he doesn't know what to do. And I said to him, mate, the trouble is you've been thinking, and what you need to do is go and become introspective. And that's when I said to him, don't sit on the beach, sit in an empty room for an hour and a half and just see what comes, because it's not until you are totally naked that you start to discover what's inside. It's not until you let go of what's outside you can discover what's inside. So it's critically important you understand that concept. If you get it,
Paul,
then it's a powerful concept.
Paul, Michael, can you give us the name of the author again, please?
Brené Brown, that's B-R-E-N-E. B-R-E-N-E, Brené Brown. Brown is spelt like the colour.
Thank you, Paul. Got it.
No worries. I say Brown spelt like the colour because sometimes there's an E on the end. She does an absolutely brilliant TED Talk. Probably the quickest way to get introduced to whether she makes any sense or not is go and listen to her TED Talk, because it's only like 20 minutes and you'll know whether you want to buy the book or not. She's written a couple of other books, but her first book, I forget the name of it, but get the first one first. That's where she makes the biggest breakthroughs. I just forget the name of it. It's something about power and vulnerability. If one of you knows it, you can say it, but at this stage, I'm kind of bereft. Okay,
I think it's the power of vulnerability or the power of imperfection. I can't remember which order they're in.
Yeah, yeah, me either.
Thank power you. Of vulnerability. Thank you.
Yeah, check it out. Okay, we've got a few minutes to get this wrapped, I think. What have I got to... Oh, no, we're right for time. Yeah, we're perfect for time. Okay, so there's a guy whose surname is Dilt. So if you want to check out this research, then you can... I'm not going to recommend it because it's scientific, so therefore it's written in the wrong kind of language. I'm going to give you the layman's version of this. But I think his name was Stephen Dilts, and he did some research in the early noughties, so, you know, 2009, 2010, that kind of region, which is the late noughties. That's when he did his research, and he discovered that that what they call the six levels of logic in terms of creating change, and that most people are not going to be able to create change until they can get things right in the order that we're about to show them to. So he talked about his six logical levels, and the first one he came up with was environment. And specifically what he's referring to there is two environments. So I'm going to talk about physically and I'm going to talk about mentally. But I'm going to come back and talk about them. I'm going to give you the six first. And so physically what I mean is your physical location, you know, the place where you work, you know, the things that are around you, the people that are around you, that kind of stuff. But the mental and emotional environment is obviously the one between your ears. So we need to talk about those together. But I'll give you the whole six in order and then come back and talk about them, because they are like Maslow's hierarchy, in as much as if you don't get that big one first, you can't get all the others. So what you'll find is when you've got people who are stuck in change, or if you're stuck in change yourself, all you're going to have to do is pull out this diagram and have a bit of a look at it. You'll recognize where you're stuck straight away. If you're working with other people, you'll recognize where they are stuck. And either way, that's going to give you a breakthrough in that. So the six levels that he talked about is firstly environment. I mentioned that's, you know, what's around you. Then there's behavior in terms of what you do and say and all those sort of things. Then there's your skill levels, because quite often people find themselves out, you know, their skill levels are just not there. They have to be developed, so that can be a complete block to change. Then there are values. In other words, a lot of people struggle with change because they can't see how it has any redeeming worth or deep value in terms of their personal way they want to run their life. You know, it lacks integrity, or it lacks transparency, or it lacks something, you know, a quality in life kind of speak. And then there's who we see ourselves as being in terms of capability and capacity, and where I fit in the world, and whether it's my right or my or a necessity for me to be bringing about change. And then there's the ultimate purpose. And so these things are progressively more powerful, but they kind of work from the bottom down. So if we start to look at environment, then essentially what we're talking about, oh, I'm going to put my colours on first, all right? So I've got a different colour for each one, just so that they can, you can kind of see how different they are. If we look at environment from the point of what do we mean physically, then it means where you live, how you work, what you do, who you work with, what the work circumstances are like, what the environment is like in terms of, you know, around your dinner table or within your family, or what are the things that you need to deal with. So, for example, I know Luke and Leah have got Luke's mum living with them, although is that still current? Is Luke's mum still living with you? Yep. So that's part of environment, because how does Sharon fit in with what you do and what she doesn't do? That's different for Gary, because Gary's got Gary and Lisa. Their two kids are grown up, and one's in Sydney, one's kind of down the road a little bit. So that makes Gary and Lisa like Paul and Mary. So, you know, there is, when I say place, time and circumstance, I don't just mean, you know, what you wear to work, or, you know, how big your house is, but of course those things relate to that. So those are the things we have to get right, because if people don't have the circumstances necessary to change, they can't. So you might say to somebody, I need you to do this extra job, but we don't have another desk for you, so we can't find a quiet place for you, so you've got to work here despite the noise and distraction all around you. And they just physically, they can't, because they can't do that, because they're just not capable of not blocking out other voices and the normal stuff that goes on in an office kind of thing. So environment matters from the point of view, it's the most basic kind of thing. Behaviour matters, because behaviour translates into what people's experiences. We can say, okay, so Fred sits over there at that table over there, but the problem is he sings along to his music, so what he says and what he does affects me from the point of view of, I know I don't like that kind of music, or I like the music, but I don't like to work to music. Or, you know, I'd rather have music for other purposes. So that behaviour of Fred's interferes with what I'm doing, so to speak. Next on the list, ability, and what that means is, what are the methods and what are the processes and what are the strategies and technical things that you know how to do or not know how to do? If you look at that from the point of view of Angela's business, then she's got a bunch of physiotherapists. Some of them can't do what others can do. Others have skills that others don't. So there's, you know, the strategies and methods. And sometimes I've heard Ange talk about, sometimes those practitioners conflict with each other about what is the best process or the best method to be dealing with someone's elbow or neck or whatever it is. So that comes down to mechanics. Next thing is, okay, why do we do what we do? This is really kind of like, you know, what the thing bigger than the job that we perform. So you could look at Global Success Academy and say, what do we do? Well, we provide personal and professional development for individuals who want to do that. But that's not why we do it. That's what we do. What matters is, we believe people deserve at least one massive breakthrough in their life. Hopefully hundreds of massive breakthroughs in their life. Why do we do that? We believe everybody deserves that opportunity. We want to be involved in providing that opportunity. Why we do what we do gets us out of bed. It's much more powerful than what we do. And it propels us forward when times are difficult, and it helps us to get through change. When Jules came to me a few years back and said, Dad, we've got to go digital, then the what was kind of go digital. The why was because we can get to more people, we can create a bigger change in the world that matters more. So, you know, that's the thing that drives us. When we go to look at identity, then that's the who we are. In other words, I said to Jules, well, can I still be who I am on camera? Can I still swear and carry on, and can I talk in my basic language, or do I have to be somebody else? Because if I have to be somebody else, that's a level, a degree of difficulty that I don't want to deal with. Well, it's a lack of authenticity that's would have a lot of meaning for me. So how we function is important as, what the function is. And then, of course, our purpose, our ultimate reason for doing what we want to do. If I stick with Global Success Academy, I've already kind of outlined that. It's in our values about why we do it. And that's got to do with being the change, not just creating change, but modelling it, being with it, providing tools for it, et cetera, et cetera. So our purpose is to change the world. That's a lot different to where's my desk. So if we go back to the bottom, if we go back to the green, where's my desk? That's a lot different to what I'm trying to achieve, so to speak. If we look at the mental stuff that's got to go with that, if we look at the mental and emotional component, then you'll see that this is where the real magic is. When you get people who can't control the environment, they just go to pieces. What I mean by that is we get somebody who's working in a noisy office, but that person needs quiet, then they just get disoriented, they get distracted, they can't produce results, they get agitated. There's a whole bunch of things that happen that mean that a perfectly logical, straightforward, very effectively functioning human being suddenly starts to come unraveled simply because the environment was not adjusted to work for them. And they get stuck there and they just can't go any further. And it actually doesn't matter how bright they are. It doesn't matter how many skills they've got. It doesn't matter how much talent they've got. They're just not able to put it together. If we go to the next level and say, let's see, we get that sorted. Then the next thing is, okay, if we get behavior that we can't cope with. So, the guy in the desk next to me sings all the time. That's what he says and does. Then what happens to me is I get confused from the point of view of why can't I have it how I want? Why does he have to behave like that? Why does he have to keep singing? The confusion becomes why. And when I'm trying to solve the why, I never really get the solution. I never really invent the third possibility. When I say to Mary, why do you always look at the downside first? And she says, why do you always look at the upside first? Neither of us find a third solution, which is there's a third way to look at this, and that's not upside or downside first, is to look at it from a different perspective. So that's what creates confusion, because from my perspective, I get confused about why Mary has to take that approach. She gets confused about why I have to take the approach that I do. We can both easily see the problem that the other one is manifesting, and we wish that they would get over that, and we get zero progress. Where you get people who do not have the skills, what you get is people who are just like a cat on a hot tin roof. So where you're asking people to change, but they don't have a method, they don't have a process, they don't have a pathway that they can follow, they don't have a place where they can go and get the skills, then what happens is they just panic. When they're asked to do what they don't know how to do, and this is where you'll find you'll come undone too, is when you're asked to do what you don't know how to do, then panic sets in and we kind of go into inertia, and inertia stops progress of any real kind whatsoever. What that means is where you see people who are out of their depth, it's your job to get them skilled up so that they can take the task on. It's what most people do is take the task off them. It's not really a smart thing to do. The smartest thing to do is to get them skilled up so that they can take the task on for themselves. At the next level, what happens is if people have to work where they're not able to bring their values into their work, then what happens is they emotionally go haywire. When we're asked to do things that we don't believe in, when we're asked to perform work that we believe is inherently bad or bad for the people that we're doing it with, then what happens is we get all sorts of emotional upheaval. That's really a big disaster for us. And of course, what happens is if our identity falls into question, in other words, if I can't do it how I want to do it, then I don't know how to do it. This is a really critically important thing. One of the first things that happened when I went to train as an instructor in this field is that the people who were training me said, have you always asked this many questions? Now, of course, you would know me as a question asker. It's one of the things that I teach. It's one of the great ways of teaching is to ask questions. But it's kind of like my way. And so I have a sense of my personality and who I am and where I fit and where I don't. I like to swear a bit. I like to be a bit rambunctious. I like to push the boundaries. I like to be different. I like to be unusual. If I'm not allowed to be that way, then I don't know how to do life in general. I don't even know how to relate to my kids. I don't know how to relate to my wife. I don't know how to relate to my work. It all comes undone if I'm not allowed to be me. You might have heard me talk in the past about, you know, people who are learning to speak to crowds. And one of the big message I say to them is, rule number one is you have to stay who you are. You have to be you. The real, authentic you has to turn up, because it's the only version of you that you can maintain with any integrity, with any energy, with any enthusiasm. The real you is the most powerful way of moving forward. And as soon as that's taken away from you, as soon as you're told how to do it, then we find it extraordinarily difficult to function under those circumstances. And then finally, what you'll find is if you can't tap into your reason for doing something, your ultimate reason, then the reason to do it just vanishes. And without your purpose being there, then it just all turns into humdrum. It all just turns into hard work. It all just turns into stuff you have to do instead of stuff that you choose to do. So I think Mr. Diltz, I think he's known as Stephen, is a bit of a genius. And I would keep this diagram somewhere handy. Screenshot it if you like and keep it around. And whenever it looks to you, whenever you notice somebody who's in emotional upheaval, the chances are their values have been compromised. You could look at all of those things that people display on the left-hand side of the screen and say to yourself, there's the cause over there on the right-hand side. This is the way to get the breakthrough in a course. This thing is a really good indicator for yourself. So use it first of all for yourself, and then use it for working with your teams. And for those of you who are coaches, then it's a brilliant tool for working with people as well. Which completes that segment, and I've pulled back a little bit of time. We're only a minute and 15 seconds over time. So thanks for hanging in there with that. I'm going to suggest to you that we go to the break, the afternoon tea break, with this concept. The only known constant in the universe is change, and yet we try and work against it. Now, if the only known constant in the universe is change, then what we know is you cannot know what's going to happen tomorrow, which takes us back to the fear of the unknown and how we don't need to deal with that, because we could just stay here instead of being in tomorrow. Okay, gang, that's that. We return for our final session at, I can't see it on my screen. Oh, no, you guys, 2:00. Okay, see you guys at 2:00.